The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. It's the Best of the Book Nook this morning. I'm Vic McCunis, and we're going to go back to 2003. For an interview I recorded with a woman named Azra Nomani. And she has a fascinating life story. She was born in India, and as a young girl, her family moved to West Virginia. And back in 2003, she had just published her first book. It was called Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. And she really has an amazing backstory. I hope you enjoy this interview, going back into our Book Nook archive, 17 years, on the Best of the Book Nook. Hello, welcome.
Hi.
To the Book Nook on WYSO, and the voice you hear is the voice of Azra Q. Nomani. Her book is Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. She joins us by telephone from West Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks so much. It's an honor to be on with you.
We hooked up on the phone a moment ago, and we got into such a chat that we kind of lost track of the time and almost forgot to do the program.
Yeah, well, all things happen, though, right?
I'll say. This is quite a story, Azra. I had not heard of this book until your publicist called me about it.
Uh-huh.
And having read it, I'm astounded. I can't believe, well, I do believe the story. I just can't believe that this happened to you.
It should be a novel, shouldn't it?
It really reads like fiction because it's just mind-boggling. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, and I guess the story really is all about yourself as well, but give us a little biography.
Okay. It's a tale where I'm the person that you're traveling with. I take you on the journey with me, and my dad, he says it well and says, you know, the beauty of the tale, though, is that it could be any one of us trying to sort of survive in this world and find our own place. But I started off right from where I'm sitting, Morgantown, West Virginia. This is the town where I grew up after I was born in India. My father came to America, got his PhD in New Jersey, and just on the eve of our departure to go move to Libya, of all places, for a job that my dad had gotten, He got his job offer from West Virginia University. We landed here, and I, you know, sort of did what every kid does, tries to find their place, and, you know, grew up on Casey Kasem and Top 40 and all right, for a new, more wider-ranging music, and tried to really, you know, find out what I was going to do with myself. I kind of knew that I wanted to go into writing, so I tried to do the good Indian immigrant kid thing and went into the sciences, but really, journalism was my heart. So I went out in the world, and my dad was just there for me. He put me in, I write about how I went for my first trip away from home to New York City for this internship at Harper's Magazine, and he drove me there in the Subaru station wagon. And nothing's really changed that much. I mean, everything's changed and nothing's changed. Mm. This book is out. It's got this picture of a torso of a woman, and he's my greatest fan, which is sort of part of this journey of how, as a Muslim kid growing up in West Virginia, I go off to India when I become a Wall Street Journal reporter. I got an assignment a few years ago to go find out about Tantra in America and how it's become such a big business.
Mm.
And so I went to Canada and California and all these crazy workshops and found out about this whole thing of tantric sex. Then I got this assignment to go to India and write about Tantra as it's practiced in the subcontinent.
My guest is Azra Nomani. The book is Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. I made the mistake of investing in the stock market a few years ago, and I normally read the New York Times every day, but I wasn't a regular reader of the Wall Street Journal until I started following some stocks. And I remember the article that you wrote about Tantra, because that caught my attention. I had heard of tantric sex. I think it's kind of a subliminal buzzword in our culture because we don't really know what it means over here.
Right.
You were trying to discover what it meant as a belief, as a cultural phenomenon, and also for yourself.
Yeah, I found out how it's practiced here in America. I mean, it's everything that Cosmopolitan and Details magazine writes about, you know, all the crazy positions and different ways of kissing and stuff like that. But I figured that there was something more to it, and in fact found out that, you know, there's a whole philosophy behind it, and that some of the greatest monks in our world are practicing Tantra. The Dalai Lama is a Tibetan Buddhist tantric. He, you know, celibate, as far as I know, and so are so many of the Rinpoches and the others that are doing a lot of the Buddhist teachings. So really what it involves, you know, is this concept that we've got these seven main chakras, right, these energy centers, and then the sexual chakra is just one of them. So really the sexual energy is supposed to be just one-seventh of the component of Tantra, but what happens is, you know, in America, we just, I guess because it's a big buzzword, like you were saying, and it's hot, really focus on the one-seventh part. But what I found then in my journey was that there's all these other elements, and, you know, the trip brought me out of New York City, that's where I was living when I wrote the article, and brought me back to Morgantown, because really that root chakra, this base, sort of from where we all survive, you know, things like paying our bills and knowing who we are is where from where we have to grow. And that's how I started my journey, is trying to put that all in order.
And you were unlucky in love.
I was. I had, you know, really been faithful to the Muslim practice of not dating until, of course, teenage years set in, and hormones or you know, just the temptations, I don't know what kicked in, but my first boyfriend was a guy I knew here at West Virginia University. He was a Green Beret of all things. You know, what a bizarre pick, right? First of all, I mean, we just really got, there's got to be past karma stuff going on there. So, yeah, I chewed tobacco, did the whole thing, and he was my first boyfriend, and I stuck with him because, you know, that's what I thought girls were supposed to do. And I just continued, you know, after I finally broke up with him, I had some really great boyfriends, but really thought that I needed to marry into my religion and culture. And so I fell in love with a man from Pakistan and thought it was everything that love was supposed to be, but it was just, you know, one of the classic cases where you just weren't well-suited for each other. And so I had a meltdown with that marriage just after a few months. The cultural clashes kicked in immediately, and we were of two different of psychologies, I think. But
it was really horrible, wasn't it?
It was really terrible. I got into the depths of it because I really wanted to... for the book, I got into the depths of it because I really wanted to be able to sort of share just how far we go sometimes, right? To really reconcile these conflicts within our life, and we try so hard, and it doesn't mean though that we succeed, and yet even failing at it, you know, like technically failing at it, brings you to such epiphanies.
And
so it did that for me.
You're very lucky. I have talked to others from India, which is a gigantic country with so many different cultures. But one thing that I've heard a lot about is the concept of arranged marriage, and also the concept of people coming to this country and trying to make sense of two cultures, trying to live in this culture and yet have those different remnants, be it Muslim or Hindu or Sikh beliefs, things that influence their relationships, parents that want them to get married, parents that want them to have arranged marriages. You're very fortunate with your family. You were very lucky.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't sign me up for, you know, the cousin that I was supposed to marry when I was born. You know, they had it all mapped out, but they didn't go with that. The thing was, it's a struggle for them, too, as it is with so many parents, where they, too, have to grapple with these cultural issues that they never even imagined. I mean, my parents saw each other after they'd been married. You know, they didn't even see each other at the time of the wedding ceremony. And that's amazing to have that kind of social life, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. But your mother was a little bit of a rebel, wasn't she? And so was your grandmother.
Yeah. And what I wanted to really do was really understand that they, too, were both just fiercely, independently spirited women. And my grandmother, she learned to drive a car in India, which was not something anyone did in her generation. Do you remember the story I wrote about where she actually then hit a rickshaw driver, though? And she was embarrassed when she told me, but she's like, well, we paid him off some 20 rupees, which would be about a dollar, and he was just happy with that. But she took the burqa off, the veil that Muslim women wear, in the city of Azamgarh, which is a very, very conservative town in the state of Uttar Pradesh, and she did it, and she was the buzz about town. I mean, everybody talked about how my grandmother had taken off the head covering. And my mother also was a woman who just wasn't going to let go of sort of what she wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, as you know, can often be a collision course between women, too. And so it was for them. I mean, it was a tough, tough time for my mom right after she went to my father's house, because it's just the, I don't know, the energy of really strong women in one place, right?
Yeah.
And so that in itself was a tough thing. And but yet, you know, I was sort of the granddaughter and the daughter of these two really amazing women. My mom, she came over to America and babysat so that she could make enough money for my brother and me to follow over. And now, like right now, she's got her own business here on High Street in Morgantown, and she's got her own thing going.
Hmm. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I went back into the archive 17 years for an interview I recorded with Asra Nomani for her book, Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love, her first book. And you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and handpicked music. And I'll continue my conversation with Asra right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. I went back 17 years to an interview I recorded with an author in West Virginia who had just published her first book. And I looked her up. I always look up these old interviews and try to figure out, first of all, number one, is my guest still with us? Is my guest still alive 17 years later? And number two, what have they been up to since? And I noticed that she's only published one other book in the last 17 years. So let's continue now with my interview going back to 2003. We call this the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest is Asra Nomani. The book is Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. It's just been published by Harper San Francisco. She joins us in the Book Nook today by telephone from Morgantown, West Virginia. There's so many elements in this book. We have your investigations into Tantra. We have your memoir. There's so much that is travelogue and adventure. And we also have Daniel Pearl, your colleague from the Wall Street Journal. It's all in this book. And when you talk about buzzing around town, I picture you on your motorcycle,
oh, yeah.
I picture you with your cousins. That part of your travel through the Himalayas and going to see the Dalai Lama, this is really amazing stuff.
It's one of those things that I say that I'm glad I lived it once, you know, because I don't know if I could do it again. It's, and, you know, I'm so, just, it makes my heart feel good that you understood the book and that you appreciate it, because I know that it's, I've given the reader a lot to digest. And I can only justify it in that it's true to life. You know, sometimes we can't put boundaries upon ourselves, and that's the tantric philosophy too, is that we have these boundaries that we live. And I started it off, this book, you know, as research into Tantra, and that was all it was going to be. But like a lot of things in life, it evolved, and I evolved, and it, you know, it just crosses those boundaries. And that was exactly like when you see me on the motorcycle and stuff, that's exactly what I was trying to do in researching the book, I guess, in living it. There were all these people I would go to at the very beginning, and I would say, like, I really want to learn about Tantra. And they're like, you know, we can't talk to you about it. You have to live it. And that's not very, that's not, like, nice to hear, right?
When
you've got your leave, and you've got this plan, and you have this book proposal you've done. Everything just, nothing fit into the script. I mean, it was a completely unscripted adventure and life tale, I guess.
I think one of the recurring themes, at least to me as a reader, was how you kept encountering these so-called gurus, for lack of a proper word, who are actually lechers.
Yeah, and it was just one of those lessons, too, where, yes, lechery crosses all boundaries, too. It does. There's these sleaze bags in every culture, every religion, right? You know, and I think that was great, and I wanted to write about it, too, because a lot of times we have these illusions, right, about people, and it's these titles that give them legitimacy, and so in this examination, you know, it was like a title as a guru or as a swami, and there's a lot of great gurus and swamis out there, but what I really found out was the greatest ones are the ones in your life, the ones that you've known for so long, the ones that have been tested over time. And that's why it was so nice to be able to legitimize forces like my mom and what she's taught me as a real guru.
Your brother was very protective of you.
Yeah.
And he suffered some difficulties. How's he doing?
Well, you know, he, it's really nice and sweet of you to ask, because he was really the one who first went to India. You know, he came with me when we were both young kids, and he really, he's a few years older than me, and he knew India better than I did. He remembered it. He was more sentimental about it. His name's Mustafa, and it's the name of the Prophet Muhammad. A real tough time, I think, especially for a boy sometimes in this culture. I don't know if girl immigrant kids, you know, we end up, the studies say, going toward our studies more, and maybe we have an easier time. But he really tried to go discover India again as a teenager, and he hit the darkness that India sometimes has for folks that come visit it and try to find out more about themselves. You know, I was mentioned that he has this, you know, rich Muslim name. Like myself, he went and he was curious about Hinduism, which is what Tantra is rooted in. And it wasn't a, you know, easy journey for him. People didn't like the fact that he wanted to go to temples, and he really imploded there, just like I did then after my first trip there. It was really, you know, his battle that really allowed me to say, like, it could really take me over if I don't get a grip on myself. And so in a way, he really saved my mind, because he went over there and really suffered without having had, you know, the insight that I had from his experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's you know, still got that tug of war with India that a lot of immigrants have. You want to be there, but yet it's really such a challenge to your psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Because the values and life is so different.
My guest is Asra Nomani. Her book is Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. We know that you work for the Wall Street Journal. You're on leave from the Wall Street Journal now.
Yeah.
And one of your colleagues at the Journal, who I mentioned before, was more than just a colleague. He was your friend. He was your volleyball buddy.
Yeah.
And I'm sure most of our listeners remember him. Tell us about Daniel Pearl.
Well, he was just an amazing guy. He and I met when I was in the D.C. Bureau. It was right after I had that marriage of 3 months, and I was going to a therapist, and she told me, Asra, you know, you have to learn how to play. You have to, you know, go back and do everything that you didn't do, being this, you know, hardcore, super-achieving immigrant kid. So Danny showed up in the D.C. Bureau right about that time. He came in from Atlanta. He got a transfer, and we started just playing. We were literally, you know, in the sandbox playing volleyball.
Mm-hmm.
We just goof around, basically. I mean, it was really great. All of my friends, all my girlfriends, I wasn't sure whether they wanted to hang out with me or they wanted to hang out with Danny because he was so cute and they were so into him. But I got over it and, you know, rode that wave. And he threw a party with me. I had never gone to my high school prom because I wasn't allowed. And so we threw this thing that we called the Midsummer Night's Prom,
mm-hmm.
all dressed up in our, you know, bridesmaids' dresses, right?
Mm-hmm.
pull that out. I had my purple velvet thing on. And we had a great time and, you know, just prove that, you know, work can be fun also, that you can be really serious about your job, but you can also, you don't have to compromise your personality. And so we encouraged each other on to the, you know, just try to write crazy words get them into the Wall Street Journal. Like he dared me once to get shanked into an article.
He did?
Yeah, so I got it in. And then,
is like this a colloquialism for some? Yeah.
You know, when you play volleyball or golf, and
then
it goes way off. So I got shanked into a work week column. I mean, it was so bizarre. and then one time I wanted to do an item for this work week. It was this column on the front page. I wanted to do something about how everybody was skipping out of work to go see World Cup soccer.
Uh-huh.
So Danny came over to my cubicle and was like, oh, we kind of need some firsthand reporting, don't we? So it's the middle of the afternoon. I'm looking at this picture of him and me at the soccer game. The couple very white guys who were clearly not Saudis. It was a game with the Saudis, and they put their T-shirts on over their heads to pretend to be sheikhs. It's close enough. So we had a great time, and all through the years, and we just would visit each other. He ended up going to London, and I went to New York, and then he went to Paris because he fell in love with a beautiful woman, Marianne. And I was in charge of, you know, the picnic at their wedding, the day after the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So I imported into France balloons so we could have the water balloon fight.
And, oh.
And I still remember the image of them like running down this beautiful yard of this garden of this lawn of this chateau with a three-legged race. They they were just tumbling all over the place.
Mm.
So I took these good American picnic sports to France. And then we both found ourselves in India. You know, he ended up getting a job for the Wall Street Journal. Marianne went over there, too, to do her work as a journalist. And I'll tell you, we were best of friends, but I never crossed paths with him in India until after September 11th because I was just too overwhelmed from, you know, Bombay. Bombay, just that's where they were living, and I just couldn't get any excuse to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So after September 11th, we all found ourselves in Pakistan trying to do the, you know, good thing, trying to cross, you know, all this talk about the clash of civilizations and the chasm. We were trying to build a bridge then, basically.
So you were in Karachi together.
Yeah, well, he was stationed in Islamabad, but it was great. I got this assignment for Sports Illustrated for Women to write about volleyball, playing volleyball in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all of this, if you can believe it, was all going to also just part be, it was all part of my research for the book because, you know, like I mentioned, Tantra is about crossing all the boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And so volleyball, finding volleyball in Pakistan and, you know, this country that had been a place of sort of bittersweet place for me. I'd been married there, and it was also, you know, really tough for me. I went into such an abyss because of the, my experience from that marriage. And so I was trying to go back and see if I could find a place for myself. And so, yeah, Danny flew in from Islamabad to Karachi on the what would have been the anniversary of my wedding night.
Mm-hmm.
And we played volleyball at Alliance Francaise, you know, the French-English school there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a great time. And that was on the December of 2001. And then we Marianne flew into town, and we had New Year's in Karachi, Pakistan.
Tell our listeners where you were on September 11th.
I was here in Morgantown.
Weren't you in India on September 11th?
I wasn't. I actually was here in Morgantown. I
thought you were in your.
Oh yeah, you know I was there. I was there September 11th the year before.
I meant that particular September 11th.
Oh yeah, I was there.
Because you talk about it in the book.
Yeah, I was in my village home. I had really. Just heard just amazing, amazing things from my mother about this home that she had known as a child. She always called it the palace, and I just couldn't even visualize it. I had dreamt about it, though, and my own just, you know, longings to know this home that belonged to my ancestors in India. And so as part of the journey, I went with two of my cousins. A favorite uncle of mine was Sufi poet, and he was just a great man. He passed away, but his two daughters carried on his legacy, and they just go through India with such abandon and free spirit that they allowed me to tackle the country in a way that, you know, I knew that I had to do in, so that I would be able to survive it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we found ourselves, you know, like you mentioned, in the Himalayas at this Dalai Lama initiation. We found ourselves swimming in the Bay of Bengal waters. And then we got on the train and went for 3 days to Lucknow, which is a town not far from our village. We got my elderly aunt, who's a beautiful woman named, I call her Rajda Khala. Khala means aunt in Urdu. And we all got in this car, piled into a car. We had this scrawny little driver, and we end up driving to our village home where, in fact, I saw this palace just before my eyes. And
is this where Bluebeard was living?
Yes. Bluebeard, who hasn't done anything bad to his wives, but yeah. This is one of our cousins who has kept, he's sort of been lord of the manor. That's why we kept calling him this.
Mm-hmm.
The house has just room upon room upon room, and he is the king there. He's been living out of the house for years. He's one of my mother's first cousins, and to his credit, he makes sure that, you know, folks don't come in and just, like, tear doors off the hinges, which happens. But, boy, he's a tough man. He just wants to have the old feudal system come back to life and be the feudal lord of our village. And so he's this strong, strong male energy, like, just oppressive.
Which isn't that really the way you would describe India? You also say to live in India is to live a lie.
Yeah, that's what it meant for me for so long, to go there and to pretend to be somebody that you're not, to pretend to have it together when you don't have it together, to pretend to be local when you're Western, to pretend so much. And what I was finding with my cousins is that, in fact, you could be true to yourself in India. You just had to acknowledge the things about yourself that were you, and then everybody else would have to just come up to speed with it.
Mm.
But he was a guy who, wanted to sort of run the show. And women in the village were always really at the whim of their husbands or their fathers. And so this is the order of things there.
Uh-huh.
The great thing is my cousin showed me that, look, it doesn't have to be that way. We can go get our own vegetables from the bazaar. We can walk through the alleys. And my aunt would take us into these homes that nobody would enter, if they didn't know who lived there. And the women hardly ever came out of their homes. They had courtyards in the middle, and that's how they would get the wind on their face. I literally had one of my cousins say to me, what's it feel to have the wind on your cheek? And I felt so sorry that she experienced that, because it's awesome, isn't it?
Your traveling companions, your two sister cousins, as you call them, are very cool, aren't they?
Aren't they great?
Mm-hmm.
I just really just love them. And my younger one, her name is Lucy, and the older one, her name is Esther. They're just poets and artists, and they live all of these principles that, a lot of us aspire to have. But, they don't have it all together. I mean, they admit it. Esther has her meltdowns, and, Lucy insists on never eating rotis made out of wheat, which is like a tough thing in India.
Uh-huh.
And so they've got their stuff, but they ultimately believe in universalism. They don't get caught up in all of these dogmatisms that really hold you down and pin you down.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have that as my vision was just inspiring to me. They allowed me to really be myself in India.
You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back 17 years to a very fascinating guest named Asra Nomani. What a life story. And her connection to Daniel Pearl, really an amazing thing. They both wrote for the Wall Street Journal. They were both in Pakistan shortly after 9/11 when Daniel Pearl thought he was going to interview someone, and he was abducted and killed. He was lured by these people. And for the last 18 years, Asra Nomani has been speaking out about Daniel Pearl, I think in a way that's probably influenced her politics. And we'll continue with my conversation with Asra right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on this final weekend of August. I'm Vic McCunis. And we went back into our archive for an interview I recorded back in 2003. I was speaking to an author about her first book, and she's only written two books so far. And this is a very interesting book and a very interesting subject. And I'm going to just let you listen to the last segment here with Asra Nomani on the Best of the Book Nook, talking about Tantrika and the abduction of Daniel Pearl. My guest is Asra Nomani. Her book is Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. And if you've been reading the press in Pakistan over the last couple of years, you might have heard her described as the baffling Indian lady. Let's talk a little bit about your friend Daniel Pearl and the fact that you were with him right before his abduction and that you became embroiled in the situation to the point where the Pakistanis thought you were a spy.
Yeah, you know, they have this idea that, you know, people from India are not to be trusted. I mean, this is a legacy of partition and a legacy of, you know, just hatred, really. It's just what happens when two countries are politically at war, the people become the casualties. And so I was this, you know, Muslim girl born in Bombay, and half of my family had moved over to Pakistan, believing in the vision of this Muslim state.
Mm-hmm.
So I really felt that this was my country, too. I felt like there was, I had a connection to it. And I felt like I, you know, no matter what, was trying to do good, you know, as a journalist. There's a lot of bad stuff going on in the publishing world, especially with it, what's happened with Jason Blair and a lot of that. But I have to tell you that there are so many folks who are in it for the vision, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Danny was one of those. He, smart guy, could have done anything. And he chose to also live a hard life traveling around the subcontinent. He didn't know the language, and he had a little dictionary, though, with him, an Urdu-English dictionary, and he was visiting then on January 23rd, the day that he went off for this interview from which he didn't return. I had gotten this awesome house in Karachi because I thought, you know, I need to write somewhere in the world. Might as well write in this city that where I had also fallen in love with a guy.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go to Pakistan at all to fall in love. I didn't at all think that, you know, my road of divine love was going to end up, you know, weaving through Pakistan again. I thought this was September 11th had just given me a little detour. But in fact, I fell in love with someone and got this house, which is so unheard of in that part of the world for a single woman to be living on her own, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I got it so it would be big enough so that I could bring my family also from Morgantown and have them visit and have them know, you know, a good, comfortable life also, a life where they could sit in the garden and they could also be who they are. I have my brother was married then in an arranged marriage to somebody from India. I have a niece and nephew, and I wanted them to enjoy the subcontinent as they are, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, these implosions that happened to their father and to me. And so I had this great big place, and then on this fateful day, on January 23rd, you know, Danny went for this interview. Marianne and I went shopping to try to get stuff for this dinner that she was going to make for my boyfriend and his friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then that night, we just kept calling and calling and calling Danny's mobile phone. And every time that darn recording would keep coming on, that person has turned off their phone or the phone is out of range. And it just was getting so excruciatingly painful because that just doesn't happen. That wasn't the kind of thing that Danny did. He would always make himself available. I would get him in the middle of interviews sometimes, and he'd be like, "Hey, I gotta get off real fast." And but he'd always make sure that people could reach him.
Mm.
So we were hoping through that whole night that, in fact, the guy that he was interviewing would had just taken him to some madrasa, you know, that might have been outside of mobile range. But then we started going on the computer, and we looked into Danny's computer and saw the name of the guy that he was meeting with, that he was supposed to be meeting with. And the guy was wanted by the FBI for suspected bombings in America, and it was just a bad scene. He was supposed to be a Muslim cleric that Danny was meeting, and Danny was going to meet him because he really wanted to try to, you know, figure out what was happening. And with a lot of the trouble that America and Islam was having, right?
You're talking about the word we hear all the time, Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he really, I mean, there was no clue that it would be Al-Qaeda involved in any of this. I mean, even at that point, on January 23rd, I was very suspicious. You know, I hadn't seen enough of the evidence that President Bush had been talking about. But then as the 24th rolled around, the morning of the 24th, the police arrived. We, Marianne and I, called over to America and told Danny's bosses and my colleagues that he hadn't come back from this interview, and reached out then to the U.S. consulate in Karachi and didn't know whom to trust. I mean, you just don't know in that part of the world who's, you know, above board and who's not. And before we knew it, our, you know, this great writing, you know, refuge that I'd found had sort of turned into a safe house. It turned into headquarters for this investigation to try to find Danny.
And your whole world really imploded. Shortly after that, you discovered that you were pregnant. And the whole situation with the abduction of Daniel Pearl destroyed your relationship with your boyfriend. And you eventually walked into you walked into President Musharraf's place and you were pregnant. What was that like?
It was just unreal. I was telling, you know, I was saying that so much of this was about identity, right? About who am I and what do I want to do in this world and what do I want to be? And so when Danny disappeared, there was no pretending. There was no more pretending. I was who I was, and I was, you know, a really aggressive journalist. I was free-spirited. I was going to tell the Pakistani intelligence guys that they weren't helping us when they weren't helping us, and that the Pakistani, you know, top anti-terrorist guy, that he was helping us when he did. I mean, it was, you know, there was no pretending anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There was no being polite just for the sake of being polite. And in fact, because of being born in India, I became sort of an excuse for some folks to blame India for Danny's abduction. It became clear that it was a case where there was this, you know, guy, Omar Sheikh, who had gotten this idea in his brain as far back as October to kidnap a Westerner. He had set up this email account back in October after September 11th that was called No Badmashi, and in Urdu, Badmashi means troublemaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just really a sick email address in itself, because that's all he had planned, and he had ensnared Danny through just charm, and he was a guy who went to London School of Economics, really smart and really articulate.
Mm-hmm.
And so he came across like a lot of folks that we interview, you know, just different. I mean, different in his views, but accessible and definitely not threatening. So the whole network of terrorism that we've heard about came, unfolded in front of me as piece by piece. I sort of saw the face of terrorists with the images of these guys that the police were picking up, and they were 20-somethings. You know, it was a lot of folks who didn't have other jobs. They had gotten disillusioned. They were unhappy with their lives. And this guy, Omar Sheikh, was able to drag them into it.
Mm-hmm.
Then there were folks who were also very ideologically wrapped up in this hatred for the West. And so the reality unfolded that there were these different cells and there was this network. And, you know, the idea that I was a spy for India didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
The police knew better. And But unfortunately, as you mentioned, my boyfriend and his family were too afraid. They didn't know what to believe, I think, and fear just so defines society over there sometimes. And that was another, you know, concept that Tantra had been teaching me, that we have to overcome our fears. And I knew that I couldn't succumb to their fears, and so I had to plow forward. and found out in our third week of trying to find Danny that, yeah, in fact, I was pregnant. I was deathly afraid of sort of what my life would be like. I didn't have a boyfriend that was willing to become a husband. I didn't have in-laws, you know, that were happy to welcome this grandchild. But I did have amazing parents, and I did have, like, this great network of friends. And I had Marianne, who, in the midst of this grief of her own, you know, just kept saying to me, "You're going to be a great mom. Mm-hmm. You have to have this baby, not for any political reasons, but just because you are going to be a great mother." And we found out the terrible, terrible news of Danny's death. I guess sort of the first week that I knew that I was pregnant, I tell everyone I had the best first trimester anybody could ask for physically, because you know, morning sickness and all that mm-hmm. stuff was nothing compared to what we were living.
Yeah.
So we found ourselves, you know, leaving Pakistan without Danny, like we'd hoped we would have. Really just had all these daydreams about, you know, the vacation that Marianne and Danny would take and mm-hmm. where they would hide away and all of that. It was such a sad memory, remembering leaving early that morning without him. And so we went through Pakistan through Islamabad to meet President Musharraf, because he wanted to talk to Marianne before she left the country. And there I was walking into his residence, I guess. It's a mansion in itself, with Marianne and with our colleagues from the Wall Street Journal, pregnant and illegal, basically, in Pakistan.
According to their interpretation of the law, you were, was it Zina? Zina?
Yeah, Zina.
Zina.
Yeah.
Well, it's an amazing story, Asra. We're running out of time, but I guess we need to name what we fear to gain power over it. And you got a wonderful gift out of this whole experience, and that's your little boy.
I did. I came back to Morgantown then and, cried a lot. You know, just had to get that out of my system. But boy, the midwives here, and you know, being in West Virginia, I got assigned a social worker. Right,
mm-hmm.
That was great.
Mm-hmm.
And they just got me in gear and put me together for that delivery day. And that was just the best moment. And that was when I finally, you know, knew divine love. I had this little boy in my arms, and I was touching divine love.
You could hold him in your arms.
Yeah, and I knew Danny would be happy too.
Well, Asra, we really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much, and thanks for really being so thoughtful.
The book is Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. Asra Nomani has been our guest. Just published by Harper San Francisco, and she joined us in the Book Nook today. If you could stay on the line, Asra.
Yeah.
I'm Vic McCunis, as always. Thanks for listening. That was Asra Nomani on the Best of the Book Nook, recorded back in 2003. I looked her up on Wikipedia to see what she's been up to lately, and she's been up to a lot. In fact, in 2016, she came out in support of Donald Trump for president. You never know where people are going to go politically. I looked her up on Twitter. She has over 50,000 Twitter followers, and this is a tweet that she sent out just this week. She wrote, "Mayhem on the streets of D.C. among social justice protesters. The far left in America is ensuring the reelection of Donald Trump. Just some free advice. If you want Trump defeated, you better get some control over your own." 50,000 Twitter followers. That's impressive. I have about 1,000. In fact, you can follow me on Twitter. Do you do Twitter? My Twitter handle is @BookNookVic. That's @BookNookVic. I spell Vic, V-I-C-K. You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. And whether you tweet a little or a lot, it's nice to have you out there listening. every weekend right here on your public radio station, WYSO.